Ron Sankowski, the lead producer of a movie called The Prophet, based on Khalil Gibran's writings and work and life. Sankowski doesn't look very Lebanese to me. How did you end up making a movie about Khalil Gibran's The Prophet?
You are right. Sankowski's a Polish name. I'm half Polish, half Italian. I grew up in Michigan, outside of Dearborn, which is one of the largest Lebanese diasporas in the world. And as such, I grew up with Lebanese food, Lebanese friends, Lebanese writing, Lebanese culture. And we all know Gibran is a national hero for Lebanon. I always had Gibran in my ear, in my brain. You know, at weddings, you would hear him quoted for the bride and groom doing their vows. At births, you would hear quote on love or on death, and at funerals, certainly. So Gibran was this figure, and just kind of then just sat there and let him go and went to college. And after college, found that I had one of his books sitting on my nightstand, and just kept tinkering with it, looking at it, and thought, why hasn't this ever been made into a film? And for those of the listeners who know the book, it's very clear why it wasn't and hasn't yet been made into a film until now. There's no real story, no narrative in it. It's 26 prose poems that talk about things from love, death, friendship, eating, drinking, work, just a variety of things where he shares his wisdom to a crowd of people, so to speak. This sat there, and then I connected up with another gentleman by the name of Steve Hansen from Ohio, who had also been wanting to make this into a book. And I think it's because
Hansen doesn't sound Arabic.
No,
either.
Right. He's, I think, Swedish, Norwegian, and same thing, surrounded by friends, kind of throwing the book at him. There's a huge Lebanese presence in northern Ohio as well. And we just thought, all right, what do we have to do to make this? And we were naive because it took over 10 years to figure out how to even get started.
How did you come across the idea of the film? I mean, turning it into an animated film with a mother who's dumb, a child. It's set in a village, of course, but where did all this come from?
Most of this came from the mind of Roger Allers, our writer-director, who is the also the writer and director of a little film you may have heard of called The Lion King.
Of course.
Yes. And Roger, I connected with Roger through a mutual friend, Bonnie Arnold, who now runs DreamWorks Animation. I sent Roger an email through Bonnie because I didn't know Roger. And it took him a month to reply because it went to his spam folder. I've since gotten to know Roger very well, but he's a Luddite in terms of technology. And
Luddite's a good term for this program. Those who fear technology. Go on.
Well, the only reason Roger then found it was because someone who shares a masseuse with Roger, I begged the masseuse to go tell Roger to look at his emails, and he finally did, and he found this email, and he replied to me, and he said, oh my gosh, I hope it's not too late. I'd be honored beyond honored to be part of this movie.
Through his masseuse. This is sounding very L.A. at the moment. You sure this is East Coast we're talking here?
Absolutely. This is L.A. now.
This is L.A.
I've been in L.A. now for the past 10 years.
Right.
The film, when you see the film, you'll see it's got a narrative. It's a 90-minute movie with 8 digressions. Each digression is a 3-minute animated piece done by a different writer-director in a different part of the world, in a different style of animation. So how do you bring all of these together? Roger is the brilliant maestro. He created a surrounding architect. He architected a story, a narrative that goes beginning, middle, and end, and it finds a nice cohesive way to tell a unifying story that then lets us go into these 8 little segments or digressions.
Tell us the story, because just for the listener who hasn't seen the movie yet might be going along, without any spoilers,
sure.
How do you get 8 poems into an animated film and do that naturally through a story? What is the story?
Sure. So just as in the book, the setting is Orphalese. So it's a fictional place that feels a little bit like it comes from the Middle East, if you will. It's an island upon which Mustafa, in the book it's El Mustafa, for the film, for practical reasons, we dropped the L because the film would not have been released in many parts of the world with El Mustafa, because that's the prophet.
Yes.
And as you know, that's a touchy topic.
Yes.
So Mustafa, who's played by Liam Neeson, and of course, this is an animated movie, so when we say played by, it's his voice. And Liam Neeson's character, Mustafa, is under house arrest. And he's under house arrest for being a poet. Okay, so it's very similar to the 14 years of exile that Gibran spent on Orphalese in the novel, or in the book. In the film, it's about 7 years. And the film opens up with a little girl who is our way into the film. Her name is Elmitra, and Elmitra's lost her voice. She cannot speak because of something traumatic that's happened in her life. And as she takes us through this film, watching Mustafa, who has been told that today's the day he's going to leave the island. His ship has come in, if you will. She tags along. She gets underfoot. She gets in trouble as he's being marched out of town, if you will, by the authorities. So Mustafa is being told to leave his place of arrest where he spent the 7 years. He's being taken to the shore, to the harbor. But as he meanders his way through the village, he stops and is stopped by a couple and a family that are celebrating a wedding. So he's asked to give some vows at the wedding. He's asked to comment to the people who don't want him to leave about work. He's asked to comment to one of the guards who's having some trouble because he's fallen in love with the mother character, Camilla. So in very organic ways, we see as Mustafa makes his way from his home in the mountains down to the harbor, that he is able to kind of impart his wisdom. And as he speaks and as he starts to talk, like he does in the book, we actually go into one of the visions of one of our directors, our other directors, and a new style takes over, and Liam Neeson's mellifluous voice reads the poetry of Gibran.
I have seen people throw themselves down and worship their own freedom, like slaves before a tyrant, praising him, though he slays them. I have seen the freest among them wear their freedom as a handcuff, and my heart bled within me. For you can only be free when you no longer speak of freedom as a goal. And how can you be free unless you break the chains you have fastened around yourself? In truth, that which you call freedom is the strongest of these chains, though its links glitter in the sun. And to become free, what would you remove that is not a part of yourself? These things move within you as lights and shadows in constant half-embrace. You'll be free indeed, not when your days are without a care, nor your nights without grief, but rather when these things bind up your life, and yet you rise above them, unbound.
We kind of fly, and we are dazzled for about 3 minutes, and then in a very organic way, we're brought back to the main narrative, or Mustafa's character, is ushered along. And I don't want to spoil it, but you know, it's not as simple as we're taking you to your ship and you're going to leave town. There's some things that happen that disturb this peaceful.
The owl whose night-bound eyes are blind in the day cannot unveil the mystery of light. In the depths of your hopes and desires lies your silent knowledge of the beyond. Like seeds dreaming beneath the snow, your heart dreams of spring. Trust the dreams, for in them is hidden the gate to eternity.
It sort of reminds me of the Stations of the Cross. I don't know, is that does that ring any bells with you?
Yeah, it does. You're right.
There's these events keep happening on the way to something happening.
Yeah.
And in each event, there is not only a new way of looking at some aspect of life or the world, but you're able to include one of these poems.
It's a great way to talk about it. And it makes it's very relatable. When you're watching this, you you feel like, okay, maybe this particular story doesn't speak directly to me, but I'm interested enough, and the next one's going to come along soon enough where I know that's going to speak to me. So just with the Stations of the Cross, depending on where you are in your life, one way or another, you're not going to be able to escape the relevance of the Stations of the Cross, just like this.
I wanted to talk to you about The Prophet itself, of course, because when I first found the book as a young man, as most people do, particularly if you're Catholic, you've got it somewhere or other, because he was a Maronite Catholic, Gibran. I didn't know that at the time. I assumed always that he was a Muslim, as a matter of fact. But when you first get it and you begin to read it, it's taken a grip on people, I think, certainly culturally over the last 20, 30 years, where whatever it is he's talking about, somehow it feels like the life people live. It feels like the life people aspire to. It feels like the life that people have suffered through. And he has these insights. Is that how you've also approached this film?
The language in the book and the language in the film are similar, and they do grip you. It does grip you. The language in the book grips you, I think, because as readers, we have a certain relationship with text on page, and I think it feels almost like a psalm, or it feels like a proverbs, or it feels something that we're very familiar with. When you move that into a movie, it's not what you normally would find as quote-unquote dialogue or narrative in a movie. It's more Shakespearean. It's kind of dusty. It's kind of hard to get your head around. So when we had to turn this into a movie, we had to work very hard to not alter the words of Gibran, but we did a little stitching here and there so that we could avoid, so we could keep the essence, highlight and kind of distill the essence, but lose some of the...
Some of it's a bit antique, actually.
Antique, the dustiness.
It is antique. He does it deliberately to be antique, doesn't he?
For what is it to die, but to stand naked in the wind and to melt into the sun? And what is it to cease breathing, but to free the breath from its restless tides, that it may rise and expand and seek God unencumbered? Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing.
I was actually surprised in researching this movie that he died in 1931. Because I thought we're talking about a guy from, you know, maybe 1850, 1820. Right. And that's the way he writes, actually.
And he wrote it in English in Boston. Most people think he wrote it in Arabic, which he didn't. You know, and like you said, you were surprised to realize he's a Maronite. He's not a Muslim.
He's Lebanese-American, of course, too. So I think he was born in Lebanon, if I remember correctly, and he moved to the States as a young kid.
Right. I think it was in 1895 or something.
Something
his family
like that,
relocated,
But we're talking about also this is a story of the Lebanese diaspora, of course.
Yeah.
And in Sydney, in Melbourne, in Adelaide, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, you'll find huge Lebanese communities, huge.
We're finding that all over the world, in fact. You're right. There are these diasporas. And where I grew up, Dearborn, Michigan, is a huge one. And I'm fascinated by it. This film took me to Lebanon to begin with, because to get the rights, we had to go to his hometown, his birth village, Beshari, Lebanon.
That'd be really interesting.
It was fascinating. When he passed away, he bequeathed his entire estate to his village, his hometown.
Really?
And they control his books, his estate, his royalties, everything. It's a committee they formed called the Gibran National Committee. It's a group of 10 men. They rotate every 2 years as a president. They speak no English to speak, you know, really. And they don't trust any Westerners. So to find a way in to get the rights really did take a long time. And we involved lots of attorneys. But then went there, physically went there and met with everybody. Earned their confidence, earned their trust, have a wonderful relationship with them to this date. I've been back to Lebanon over 40 times in the past 3 years and have fallen in love with the culture, the people, the country. And you realize how powerful Lebanon is, how influential Lebanon is around the world, not just through Gibran, you know, through fashion, through food, through music.
Yep.
It's amazingly potent, the culture. I'm constantly surprised and blown away.
Well, can we just talk about that name, the Prophet, though? I do want to go back to that, because you said you couldn't refer to him as El Mustafa, because if you did that, you could have a problem. But, of course, here, don't we have instantly part of the essence of Lebanon itself, where the villages tend to be Maronite and Christian. There are plenty of Orthodox Christians there too. But I think now it's probably 50% Muslim as well. And that whole area lives in a certain tension as well, which Gibran seems to overcome somehow.
Yeah. When we released the film is called Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, because we definitely had to...
No mistake.
Set up a distinction. I spent a lot of time in Dubai, and it's interesting, there's two big bookstores in Dubai. You have Borders, which, of course, has gone bankrupt around the world, but it's still alive in Dubai. And you have another store that's, I don't know, remember the name of it. In one, all of Gibran's works are outlawed, forbidden to be in the bookstore.
Because of the prophet.
Mm. In the other one, you can get everything.
Because the prophet is Muhammad, who is the one and the only prophet. And, of course, this is why when I was little, I thought Khalil Gibran was Muslim, because the book was called The Prophet.
Exactly.
And when you read it, Jesus is not mentioned. Mary is not mentioned. Right. It is a universal language he's trying to do in poetry.
Right, right.
And that seems to be part of his genius and why Lebanon has taken him up, that he's not a sectarian somehow.
Not at all. Not at all. He mentions the word God, but he doesn't. But it's more of a spiritual reference.
Yep.
And one funny little thing was I came back from Dubai or Lebanon when there was a big outcry over an online video called The Prophet, the message of the Prophet, and it was used as the excuse to incite the violence at one of the embassies, the U.S. embassies. Mm. And as I landed, I was stopped at customs, and the guy said, coming from a hard part of the world, you better be careful. I was like, no, it's fine. I'm making a movie over there. And he goes, oh, okay.
Must be all right then.
Yeah, I said, it's based on The Prophet. And I had no idea. I had been in a plane for 15 hours. I had no idea that this violence had happened. And it literally was based on a movie based on The Prophet.
Oh, which
was
no.
The
violence.
So the guy asked me to step aside. He goes, I'm not sure why you're telling me this, but can you please go over here?
We need to search you.
Yeah,
we'll
so
check
I got
in.
Stopped for the first time and explained everything, of course. And they laughed. But people think of The Prophet by Gibran as something other than what it really is, which is fine, but it's an education. We really have to educate everybody. When people see this movie, they're going to see a movie that's really a work of art more so than anything. It's not a screed. It's not anything to do with religion in any overt way. It's spiritual, and it speaks to people's souls, and it nourishes them in lots of different ways, depending on where they are in their lives. But it's been a constant battle.
It's really fascinating to hear that you've had that to and fro, because, again, Khalil Gibran himself, in his own life and in his own writing, seems to avoid the sectarianism that is so easy to fall into. I have friends who are Maronites. I have friends who are Muslims who are Lebanese. And I remember when I was much younger, the Maronites reminding me that they are not Arabs, they are Phoenicians. We are descended from the Carthaginians. We are not Arab, they say. They speak Arabic, of course. These are Catholics who worship in Arabic, but they distinguish themselves ethnically. They even told me we're Semites, which is almost like trying to make sure that I'm as different as I possibly can from a Muslim Lebanese person, if you know what I mean. I'd be really interested in looking at the genetics of it all, to be honest.
Yeah, there's a gentleman. Have you heard of Amin Maalouf?
I have.
So we're doing two movies with Amin Maalouf, two of his books, turning those into films, and Leo the African and Ports of Call. And when you have a conversation with Amin Maalouf about this topic, about identity, Arab identity or the Maronite identity, and how people go out of their way to be perceived a certain way, it does, speaking to your point, it makes you want to study the genetics. It makes you want to understand.
How factual is this? Yeah, how much is this as a self-perception? Yeah. How much is this a cultural way of identifying? And how much is it really based on a genuine difference that is not simply able to be thrown away?
Right.
And in one sense, that's what Gibran tries to do. He universalizes, doesn't he?
Yeah. He universalizes almost to a point where people find fault sometimes.
Because... Not Christian enough. Not Muslim enough.
Yes. Exactly.
He stands apart from it, doesn't he?
Too watered down. It's one big fortune cookie. It can mean anything to anyone at any time.
Ron Sinkowski, who's the lead producer on The Prophet, it's the animated film. which captures the poems of Khalil Gibran, the great Lebanese poet and writer. Now, small town girl, of course, from the dizzying heights of working to clean dishes to now running around the world making films, small town means something to everybody, and it does indeed in Lebanon mean something, because in Lebanon, your town is just about everything about who you are, isn't it?
True, very true. It's a country of villages. It's a country of neighborhoods. It's all about family there. It's all about tribes. When you go there, before I started to visit the region, I couldn't have told you three things about the Middle East. I couldn't not have told you the difference between Dubai, Lebanon, Jordan, anything. Now sure. I can speak very,
but pretty confidently compared.
I'm still stupid, but I mean, I can tell you quite a bit about Lebanon and Beirut and the villages and how it works. And it's just stunningly beautiful. And when people ask me, what's it like? I'll go through the checkout line in Valencia, California, where I'm going, just small talk. And I'm going to Lebanon. They'll say, be careful, don't get beheaded. And I just look at them, and I'm like, what are you talking about? If I dropped you in the middle of Beirut, you would think you were in Beverly Hills. It's that beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Mm. There was this TV series in the U.S. called Homeland, and they had two episodes set in Beirut. They had tanks going down Hamra Street as a dirt road. Okay, Hamra Street's paved with Virgin megastores and bowling alleys and Victoria's Secrets. It's like, it's not what people have portrayed in the media, and it's really sad. There's a lawsuit actually with the government of Beirut suing the producers of that show for defamation of character of their city. There's evidence that there's been some violence there in the past. I've been there when there have been tires burning and blocking the airport. I've been there when there have been bombs that have gone off. But at the same time, you know, we've had violence in Colorado and movie theaters in the U.S.
Missouri.
Yeah, in Missouri and Ferguson.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, this happens, and it's not because we're in Beirut or because we're with these villages that are identified by certain, you know, religions and belief systems. These people have learned to coexist just like any other neighbors of opposite sides. So
it's the funny thing that this area, which is rent at the moment in many ways because of different factions, and Lebanon has a most unusual settlement of government with representation of Muslim, representation of Orthodox, representation of Maronite, every attempt to try to make the thing work. And for a long time it did work. And perhaps even now it's starting to work again because we hear better and better news coming out of Lebanon. But in one sense, you're seeing, as you visit here in Sydney right now and as you move on to other places, the diaspora, many have left, and there's a huge outward going that has happened.
Right. There's a movement there called the LDE, the Lebanese Diaspora Energy, and it's this whole thing of trying to get the well-moneyed or successful people who have left Lebanon to reinvest in Lebanese companies so that they can kind of do a little bit of both. So there's a recognition by the prime minister and Gibran Basile and these guys who realize, yeah, the diaspora is out there. There's more people outside of Lebanon, more Lebanese outside of Lebanon than there are inside Lebanon. At the same time, they all feel a longing for their home country, and they want to figure out how can we help it. So they have formalized this thing through the Lebanese Diaspora Energy so that mm-hmm. you can make an investment in a company that promises to reinvest and grow something inside the country.
So there's a way of helping yeah. while still living outside the nation.
Yeah. And we were asked to be part of that and to present an opportunity for people. So we did. We made presentations in Los Angeles as the inaugural event at this thing. And I don't know why, but yeah, I keep gravitating back towards Lebanon. And I we have a new company built in Lebanon. We are doing projects in Lebanon. And maybe I was Lebanese in another life.
Well, I have to say that you could pass. You could. Because you've got olive skin, you're actually wearing a beard at the moment, and you could pass. You stand in the crowd. I get mistaken for it too. So you could be an honorary Lebanese person. What have you learned most about it? I mean, what's the most surprising stuff you've learned about Lebanon through this whole process? You're dealing with their greatest, really, probably their greatest export. What have you noticed about them?
Yeah, making this film, I've been able to meet the highest level of politicians, cultural, financial, music, everybody. All with a great interest in this film. We had a hugely successful premiere in Beirut a few months ago. We brought Salma Hayek to Lebanon. We just crushed the internet there, and everybody with a camera showed up at every place where we were. It was just an astounding event. But that then goes away, and I stay, and I play Taula, I play backgammon all night long with lots of different guys sitting in cafes and smoking shisha, and you're just picking up, and you're learning, you're seeing. The things I've noticed there's some cliches that are true, okay, which is this is probably one of the hardest partying cities in the world, and I don't know if it's because they feel like, listen, we're living for today, we're living for tonight.
The end times are here,
exactly.
All those,
yeah. Exactly. The most advanced clubs, this is puts Ibiza and Vegas and Miami to shame. The clubs in Lebanon are phenomenal. And so you have a real sense of joie de vivre, people living for the moment. Mm. You do have, you know, in the summer, you have, this is one thing I learned, Ramadan, the whole region goes into a coma. You can't get anything done during Ramadan. And Ramadan just happened in July this year. And
That would have been virtually summer, would it? July?
Yeah, it moves every year. It moves up a month.
Yeah.
And so it's cruising through summer right now. Next year it'll be August. It'll be June, May, June. This year it was like a little bit June, July.
Well, their problem in summer is it's a long, long day to eat nothing between sunrise and sunset.
It's tough. Yeah. We were in, this is funny, but in Dubai, the world's tallest building, they actually, since if you lived at the top of that building, sunset's a half hour later. So you actually get an exemption from the kingdom to be able to violate it before the sun sets. Traffic is worse there than it is in L.A., in Beirut. Beirut driving, there are people in Beirut, Lebanese people, don't like to stand in line. They don't like to follow the path of lines on the road for cars. You know you're on a Lebanese airplane when you are coming into a town or taking off when everyone's standing up way before the plane has landed because they don't care. They just don't care. They want to be first. They don't respect order. It's chaos. Chaos rules.
You're here for the launch of the film here at the St. George's Lebanese Film Festival. It's a big deal. If people are listening right now, why do they want to go and see The Prophet? How will it affect them, do you think? Young and old, Lebanese or not Lebanese, why do they want to come?
They will have to come to the second screening because it's sold out, I've been told. But
congratulations.
Listen, if I'm going to see a movie and I can go see Mission Impossible or Trainwreck or The Prophet, you know, it depends on the mood. It depends what you're up for that night. If you have had enough of spandex and capes and you've seen the superheroes you've needed to see for the summer and you're looking for a different type of entertainment, The Prophet is a film that is not going to it's going to take you inside yourself. It's not going to let you
reflective.
Escape.
Yeah. Reflective.
It's opposite of escapism in a way. It's very reflective. And if you're at a place where you're thinking about something, whether it's a loss or whether it's a transition in your life, it's very cool. You'll sit there and you'll appreciate the meditative state. The Gibran is timeless because this is what he does, right? He reflects back onto us whatever it is we are searching for, and the film I think achieves that. It's a very sophisticated film, and I think even young children can identify with it and so forth. But you know, I think 9-10 years old is probably the floor for this, and then
older than that,
yeah.
For those who are sitting listening to us right now in Perth, in Darwin, in country areas, is there any way they can see this, get hold of it? How can they do it?
Well, you can go to our website, The Prophet Movie, Gibran's theprophetmovie.com. We have all the domains, but somehow you'll get there, and it'll tell you when it'll be coming to your area. Australian distribution timing of that is not yet set. So I don't have a firm.
So we've got to go to the website. We'll connect it up to our website for people who are interested, because I have no doubt that there will be literally millions of Australians who know exactly who Khalil Gibran is, know exactly what The Prophet is, and might be just fascinated to come and see such a film.
Cool.
Thanks. Ron Senkowski, the lead producer of The Prophet. It's the animated movie based on Khalil Gibran's writings and poetry. It's being shown at St. George's Lebanese Film Festival in this week. It's the largest showcase of Lebanese film now in its fourth edition, that festival. Ron, thank you very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.